Hello, and welcome to Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about an older comic book storyline.
This is Back Issue Spotlight number 48 for Secret Wars number 5-8. So we are in the middle third of this series, and again, historic series early, I think, in kind of the what now seems like early in the continuity of the Marvel Comics and stuff. And it's not that it's taking me a while to get used to the different storytelling style, because I grew up in this era and this is my introduction to Marvel. I love some of this, but it really does kind of highlight for me some of the differences between kind of then and now, art and production value wise, storytelling wise, and just how much these characters have grown and changed over the decades. It's just kind of crazy.
Yeah, I love this stuff. This is still probably my favorite kind of era and style of comic.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, there are things that I don't remember necessarily in that great love, and some characters either vastly different now or they were just terrible.
Well, I think it's a matter of our expectations based on what we know of the characters now.
Yeah.
There are certain aspects of the characters that ring true throughout time, but there's other aspects where this is a little more melodramatic. The story moves at a bit of a breakneck pace, and the characters aren't as nuanced and sophisticated as they've grown over the intervening decades.
All of those things are probably true. And I think in some ways, some are more nuanced and more sophisticated.
At this point than they are now?
Yeah.
I can see that. I can see that, actually. For a couple of them, yeah.
Charles particularly comes to mind.
I was actually going to go with Absorbing Man.
There's another one.
Because there's a couple that have almost, I don't want to say become caricatures of themselves since then, but where they focus and how they treat the characters has evolved over the years, as I would hope and expect.
Yeah, at least for me, this Charles is more likable than more recent ones.
I can see that. He's a character that's gone through many iterations, and how hardcore he is on mutant rights and versus peaceful living with humans and versus this, that, and the other.
Yep.
How controlling he is and how trusting he is of his students has changed a lot over the years. And some of that's just with different creators over time. And there's an aspect where I think Shooter's writing here is influenced by 12 issues, needs to hit certain story beats to kind of, you know, sell the toys and stuff like that. And there's just so many characters in this story that you can't give any one of them the focus they might get if this was their own title.
Well, of course, that is certain true. That being said, at least to this point, with maybe the exception of Hawkeye, I don't think any of them are overly short-changed.
I don't think Captain Marvel has gotten a lot of screen time.
That might be the other one.
And I think the X-Men tend to be treated more as a group than individually.
Yes.
And I think on the villain side, understandably so, they're not getting quite as much screen time in general. And most of the individual ones, I don't think, have gotten as fleshed out as, again, we might expect from a modern comic.
Yeah, those things are probably true. But
I would expect that from a comic of this era.
Yeah, and I'm trying to find a diplomatic way to say this, I guess. The villains, while they are recognizable past Doom and Galactus, are kind of just the random henchmen, with a few exceptions and individual scenes with a couple of
them. I mean, I get what you're saying. I don't consider them specifically to be random henchmen, but to your point, they're being treated like random henchmen, I would agree.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Because I'm not saying they can't be more.
Well, it's a very lopsided group we've got.
Yes.
When you've got Enchantress, Ultron, Galactus, Molecule Man, and Doctor Doom, and Kang on kind of that, any one of them could be a threat for the Avengers. And then you've got, like, the Wrecking Crew, Dr. Octopus, and Lizard.
Yeah.
You know, I would expect if the Lizard came up against just the Fantastic Four, or the Avengers, or the X-Men, much less all of them, it'd be like, yeah, game over kind of a thing. So I don't know if that was the right choice or selection of villains, but I'd have to give some thought as to who was available back then and who would have been another good pick. Because it's not like I would have put, like, Batroc the Leaper or something in here, although that could have been quite fun. It does seem, though, like a lot of the times when the Wrecking Crew is being used, they're manning the guns on one of these alien platform things. And it feels like any thug could have done that. You know, it would have been fun if the Beyonder had picked a little further afield in addition to the heroes, the villains, but had gotten, you know, a platoon or whatever from SHIELD, one from AIM or HYDRA or something like that to kind of round things out.
And I'm not current at all, and I don't know if I've read everything of Doc Ock. This Doc Ock feels more henchman-like than the genius that seems more Doom-like in most of what I would think of Doc Ock.
This is well before the era in which he kind of came into his own to the level you're thinking. Not that he was ever a second-tier villain or anything. He was always a major Spider-Man villain. But this was when he was more likely to be dating Aunt May than taking over the world.
Well, yeah.
And I think part of it with some of these characters, and Doc Ock's a great example of it, in the intervening years after this, they built up the character, he got more confident, he got taken more seriously, and if we were to have these same events or situations play out with the modern version of the characters, man, it would be totally different. Again, the way Doc Ock acts in it would be fundamentally different because he's got definitely that superior attitude these days that he isn't showing in this comic.
Yeah, exactly.
And to me, it's not so much an is the character out of character, because I'll be honest, I'd have to give some thought as to, well, where was each of these characters at that point in time? But it just, again, underscores how much they've changed over the years. And again, it would be fun to see the same situation play out, but with the modern take, because you know the minute they're all in that arena in that first issue, yeah, we all know each other, what's happening this time would be the attitude, not a, hey, let's introduce each other because we don't know, you know, everybody.
That is true. It did get an updated version of this, and to be fair, I prefer this one to that one still.
Well, I guess to me, while we got a newer Secret Wars story, I would almost like, I think it would be hilarious to see the take of the characters from that Secret Wars era drop back into this story.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, but I'm trying to, I mean, that,
because there's some major differences between the two.
There absolutely are. And that was, what, 9 issues for the mini? And then there was, like, 15 of those 3-issue mini series to go with it?
Something like that. I'd have to go look it up. I lost count. It had a lot more space to play with overall.
And not, I don't, most of the stories had as much happening as these first 8 issues have anyway.
No, there's an aspect of this where things are going at just a breakneck speed in some of this stuff where, and you know, I mentioned this last time, it seems like at the drop of a hat, a fight would break out. But the point of the matter is they had time for a number of fights per issue and still move the story and characterization along.
Exactly.
So I don't want to say that no time was wasted, because there's a couple of things where you, like, the opening to issue number 5 here, where we open on a splash page of the reaction of, oh, what does it mean? You know, kind of a thing. Did they need a full page for that? Could they have tightened it up? Yeah, maybe, whatever. But there's a fundamental difference in the pacing of the story in this era of comics from today, and this whole bit with what's going on with Galactus, you know, in a modern take, would have been its own miniseries.
Yes.
And we'd have gotten a more in-depth, more nuanced version of it, no doubt. But again, the speed with which stuff's happening here, you miss an issue, you've missed some stuff. Things happen.
Well, yeah, and more nuanced, I don't want to say is incorrect. I just because you have more time and do less on a page doesn't mean you necessarily tell a better story.
Oh, and I'm not suggesting it's a better story. I guess my point, and let me clarify it, because you're right to call me on that, is that we would have spent more time in the moment, whether the moment needed more time or not.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that to me is the difference, is these days, like some of the stuff that's happening in this issue, there wouldn't be room with the modern storytelling techniques to fit it all in. Yet there are other things in this issue that it does feel like they kind of gloss over, and in one or two of the later ones, definitely kind of gloss over.
No, absolutely. And the other thing is, again, this, you know, starting kind of issue 5, the what's going on with Galactus, and you kind of get the setup of that, and then you get the kind of mind-reading drug thing.
Yeah, the breathing of the vapors.
And but then there's that entire page, well, one side of a page, that's basically a giant recap.
It's about a page and a half, actually, yeah.
Well, But the one real, yeah, that page. We get
the page where we get, here's all the heroes that are here. Here are all the villains that are here. Here's how Battle World was created.
Yes, exactly.
And even halfway into the next page, they fought, they had the mountain dropped on them, all this kind of a stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we get a fair amount of recap to where if you missed the previous issues, you're not totally lost, but you know there's more story to read. And it, you know, the one panel that's kind of like recapping issue 4 there of, well, they had a mountain dropped on them. It's like, ooh, I wonder what happened there. I should go find out.
Yeah.
You know, it entices you to read the story, I think, or at least it did for me at the time, because at this period in comics, the comic store I was shopping at had, you know, back issue bins. And it's not like comics were just coming out at the gangbuster paces they'd been coming out up until the pandemic. But, you know, I'd read a back issue of Superman. I'd go to the letter page and they'd say, what an awesome issue they'd done like 4 or 5 issues ago. So I'd go back. I'd, you know, find that one, read that. And for a while, my Superman stuff, I was going back, you know, on an almost like a quarterly, you know, snippet kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because they would tempt you to read it with what they were telling you. And the fact that they've got so much story to recap and are able to do it kind of so quickly, I appreciate, because again, modern storytelling, this page and a half wouldn't be there and they would just assume you remember everything that's happened.
Yes.
And given that these days they aim for the trade, it makes sense, because if you're reading this in the trade, it's like, I just read this a few minutes ago. So, I mean, I get why they've dumped that stuff, but I think it makes it more of an accessible story.
And I'm not saying I couldn't, but I will say that, and not that there were the breaking points to make it easy to do, but again, back to like when we were doing the Earth One stuff, I would pretty much read those in one sitting.
Mm-hmm.
These, I get to that end of the issue, here's the next cover for the next issue, and kind of go, okay, I'll read the next one tomorrow. You know, I need a break. Whereas that's not as true reading a modern trade.
It's funny because I know exactly what you're talking about. I pretty much entirely agree with you. However, I did not come out of these issues as exhausted, I guess would be the best word, as say, like when James and I were doing the Doomsday Clock ones. Because those were 30-ish pages. These are what, actually I haven't done a page count, but about 20, I think. And it's, I don't know, it's a different kind of storytelling, because there's a lot going on here, and I feel very satisfied at the end of these issues.
Well, yeah, I guess that's it. Doomsday Clocks, I have a slightly, I think I enjoyed it more than you or James, so that in one sense is going to change my opinion, but I think that's a bad example.
It's an atypical example, absolutely.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more current or close to current trades that I've read where I don't necessarily remember the difference between issue 2 and 3 or 3 and 4, or, you know, this book, that's not true.
Yeah, in this book, each issue of this and this era of comics was telling something that had to be satisfying enough on its own to justify the cost of it and enough of the next issue to get you to buy that next issue.
Yeah.
And it was a competitive market back then, not that it's not now, but because you got a bigger story chunk per issue, if you were to write up a synopsis of each one of these issues, there would be like issue 4, you know, they had a mountain dropped on them or whatever, and there'd be more to put in there than just that, because it wasn't the only thing that happened. But today, if you do a synopsis of it, the synopsis can cover 3 issues because there's not as much happening.
Yeah.
Again, it you know, Spider-Man fights Doc Ock for 6 months versus, you know, 16 pages or something back in this era.
Yeah, and you know, most of those eras, you know, those kind of fights, that wasn't 16 pages even. It was 4 or 5 pages. And then mm-hmm. There was kind of other little stories mixed in.
Yeah. I would say the closest example to that kind of storytelling these days is probably over on Black Cat, because there seems to be almost the done-in-one heist aspect of a bigger story.
Yeah.
But what gets me with this is not only do they take the time to recap and kind of just keep the story moving, but like on the end of this you know, recap kind of breathe the vapors, you know, whatever the hell that was. We've got Colossus there, you know, pining for Kitty.
Yep.
So we get a panel to go, you know, this character has a love interest. We're not showing her here, but he's missing her and going for that kind of characterization and stuff. Now, you could argue it's heavy handed. You could argue, oh, they've got to do it with captions and thought balloons. But I think the captions that are done by an omniscient narrator in combination with like Colossus's thought balloons gives us a storytelling vehicle that you really just don't get in most other forms of entertainment.
Yes.
And I miss that aspect of comics, and I think that was a mistake for writers to get away from it, and I think, not to say they should embrace it whole hog and everyone should do it, but I think it should come back.
Well, and I've said that, I know not everyone agrees. I don't really feel like the thought balloons have gone away. They've changed the narrators into the character retelling the stories more than an omniscient narrator with the characters having thought balloons.
I agree and disagree. I think what they've done is remove the thought balloons and just put them into the captions.
Yes, but the captions in these days tend to be much more like an omniscient. They don't necessarily have a specific, now you get the captions where it's clearly one of the characters speaking, and they use all kinds of color and other visual cues to tell you which character is kind of retelling or speaking the parts now.
Yeah, it's off-panel dialogue that's happening versus actual narration. And to me, it's a fine line between an off-panel discussion and a voiceover.
Exactly.
You know, to me, it's like if you were to watch a heist film and they're talking through the planning as they're cutting through them actually doing the heist. That's an off-screen discussion. Whereas if you go to like the old MacGyver show and he's telling the story about how his grandfather told him the story, which is how he got the idea to do this kind of bizarre, you know, jury-rigged trap or whatever. That's, again, a different style and such.
Well, and that's one of the things that was never done, almost never, in the older days. That's done all the time now, is that time displacement.
Mm-hmm.
That is so, and so now you really get, well, this happened. Let's go back 30 hours or 3 days, whatever it is. And inevitably, the narration at that point is not a true narrator as much as it is the character that experienced it kind of retelling the story.
Well, and the danger with that narrative technique is if it's very clear that's what's going on, you know the character survives.
Well, of course.
But there should at least be the illusion that they won't.
Fair enough.
But like some of the thought balloons when Colossus is worried about Kitty and stuff like that, it's not something that you could just flip those to captions and the scene would play the same. So I think there's a different tone and style to these thought balloons in this era of comics that allowed for some storytelling possibilities that we just don't get these days.
Yeah, that's all probably true.
We get Galactus's ship coming, and we get, you know, the X-Men reacting to it and all of that stuff. And what gets me is there's a couple of times where the thought balloons here are being used to set up kind of the who's leading the X-Men right now quandary.
Well, a lot of that's actual dialogue and some of it's thought balloons. And yes, it is, hey, I thought we were the X-Men, and you get the, hey, Storm, I thought I was in charge. Scott was, well, oh, this is such a big deal. Maybe I should be in charge again. And then you get Charles going, no, me and Magneto are in charge. You guys go do what we say.
Right, but all of Cyclops' stuff, he's thinking.
Cyclops is all thought balloon, yes.
Whereas Storm is flat out saying.
Yes.
So, it gives some possibilities of seeing into the character's mind to color some stories, whereas if those thought balloons weren't there, as they wouldn't be today, you would think Cyclops has no problem with all of this.
Well, yes, that is true.
So, again, just different storytelling style over the years.
Yeah, you know, and then you get the whole sequence after that, back with the villain.
Yeah, there was one or two things about some of this with what's going on with the villains, but I'll touch on that in another issue or two.
Okay.
But it some of it starts here.
Yes.
Or at least where I first noticed it. I did think it was funny to see Thunderball and Absorbing Man kind of comparing their balls and chain.
Yes.
That was just kind of funny. And I had a lot of the toys for this, and I don't know if either of them came out as a toy, and I'm pretty sure they didn't come with their ball and chain if they did. I meant to look up what the toy line was because it's been ages since I bought them as kids. But there was a little bit of infighting with the villains because, well, you know, they're villains and, well, drop of a hat. But it was fun. It was in character. And I think Molecule Man is another one that the way he acts here, the way he acts now, is just really different. Not better or worse or uncalled for, but again, it shows how much these characters have changed over the years.
Yeah, to be fair, other than this and the newer Secret Wars, I'm not sure I've read a lot of Martin, so.
He'd shown up in a couple of other places. He's not used as much these days. I think part of it is they'd amped up his powers so much that he's not a threat if he's fighting you. It's just kind of a foregone conclusion. You'd probably lose. So they, I think, turned him into something of a pacifist almost, which when a character gets so powerful, you almost have to.
Back to Doomsday Clock, Doc Manhattan almost.
Yeah, I can definitely see the parallel there. I did think it was funny when Enchantress tried to essentially seduce Doom, and it's like, yeah, that's not going to work.
Yeah, I mean, I still think that scene's important for several reasons, but yes, I can see how you can also say it's kind of ridiculous.
It's more that she thought it would work was ridiculous than anything else. I did think her approach of, I can heal your face, was needed, and not a bad plan on her part. But to think that he could essentially be seduced just shows how much she didn't know him at this point in time.
Well, yeah. I'm trying to remember where this falls in the Fantastic Four. And I want to say it's in the 280s.
I want to say it's about a year before that.
Okay. I'm not sure the idea that it wouldn't work is as insane an idea then as it is now.
True, because at that point, his whole scarred face and the vanity, I think, was being played up a lot more.
Exactly. It's not until after that point that you get the more megalomaniacal and the less damaged Doom.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the challenges of reading something from, you know, a few decades back that's, I don't say steeped in continuity because it's not, but the characters are at a specific moment in time and it can be hard to place that moment.
Well, yeah, but I would argue a lot of what you think of Doom now is directly because of this series. I think arguably everything about Doom now has as much to do with these 12 issues as anything else.
I don't know, because for me, the core of Doom's character goes back to the origin story of the Fantastic Four and his relationship with Reed in college.
Absolutely. But again, I think there was the jilted lover, the underdog, the scarred man we were just talking about is different than the totally confident megalomaniacal version we have. And I think a lot of that kind of starts here.
I don't know, because, and again, I'd have to see exactly where this fell with the Fantastic Four and refresh my memory of that era of the Fantastic Four. I was thinking even at this point, he was, you know, total ruler of Latveria that we've known and loved ever since.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess to me, while certain facets of the personality have been highlighted by different writers at different times, I don't see this as being a fundamental forging point for the character.
Fair enough.
I could be wrong on that, and you could probably persuade me otherwise. It's just... I'm trying to remember if this was before or after when some of the writers were using Doombots and discrediting each other's stories. Because there's the one story in which, you know, Arcade strikes a match off Doom's armor, and then in another comic a little while later, Doom sees one of his Doombots with that strike of the match visible on it, and he blasts the Doombot, because, well, you know, the real Doom would never let that happen. You know, and there was some back and forth with the writers and stuff, and I just don't remember if that was before or after this.
Yeah, and again, I'm not sure. That's why I'm trying to remember, because I think a lot of the current Doom comes really from John Byrne's portrayal of him,
mm-hmm.
which is from kind of the mid-230s into, like, the 280s.
Yeah, a lot of that was already happening by the time of this.
Yeah, so... Okay, so, yeah, again, maybe you're right. Maybe this was already them by that point. But again, it still was a long way from the original.
Well, and it is a key story for Doom. But I think the biggest change with the character between then and now is a lot of writers taking the attitude of he's the hero of his own story.
Absolutely. He always has been.
Yeah, but I think they started writing it more that way. He always was that way in his own mind.
Yes.
But when the writers got on board with that.
Yeah.
And you started to get a little bit more of that perspective, I think it really added some nuances to the character.
Yeah, no, that's all of that's totally...
So we then get the heroes trying to, you know, get the attention of Galactus because they're realizing, yeah, him eating the planet, probably not good for us. What I found interesting is it seemed to be, and exactly how Magneto was able to kind of supercharge Professor X's telepathy, not quite sure, but whatever. That seems to be what gets Galactus's attention. But since he's been alerted, he also swats, you know, Reed and one or two others. The whole we're but insects before him sort of attitude. Classic kind of thing to do with him.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't recognize this construct or cat or whatever it was that Galactus sends down to beat up on the heroes. Should I have?
I didn't specifically, but Galactus is kind of, or we've somehow been able to produce these minions to do stuff like that for him?
It doesn't seem to be like a herald, though.
Well, maybe, maybe not. Yeah, but yes.
So they needed something to fight. They got something to fight. So
exactly.
But again, you know, big fight scene at the drop of a hat, and it fits in the story and doesn't feel like, oh, they're playing for time or something.
Mm.
You know, and there were some definite stakes to be had with this guy.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and then, of course, the key to the whole thing, you know, the distraction to get Doom on the ship.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, this is one of those times where when the villains show up, they're in one of those platform crawler things. Half the wrecking crew is just manning the guns. And I couldn't tell exactly what Doc Ock thought he was doing there other than just, you know, pontificating as if he were in charge. So, but the whole bit of Doom just waiting for the moment to where he could get aboard Galactus's ship was kind of cool. Little unclear where that ship he was in, where it came from and why it was just sitting there by the edge of a mountain or something. But yeah, whatever. The availability of convenient tech on this planet is pretty impressive.
There's lots of random ships just wandering around. Everyone seems to be able to use them until that brings us to the start of issue 6,
mm-hmm.
where we have a ship in the Wasp and someone who is struggling mightily to use this ship and feeling it isn't meant for humans.
What I found interesting is we'd go on an entire issue without her even mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff, and it's like, okay, that's odd. And then after she crashes pretty spectacularly, she, I guess, bumps a button or something, and suddenly she's getting a map to where she needs to go. That, to me, I couldn't tell. It seemed like contrived storytelling. I couldn't tell what motivated it, what she was expected to see, you know, why she got the map, you know, why the map was even on the thing.
Well, and there's so much of this, oh, woe is me, I'm the helpless girl, thrown in, it's hard to tell what she's doing. Because the map appears as she's complaining that there's no salons and she doesn't have an emery board to fix her nail.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's really kind of wonky and doesn't hold up well.
It ends up getting her to where the lizard is.
Yes.
But there's no reason to have thought that's what it was going to be. And again, I couldn't tell the motivation for either the ship or anyone else to have given her that.
Well, no, she stole the ship from Magneto back at the end of 3.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, Magneto kind of wanted Charles to stop her, that's when Charles kind of says, no, we can't do that, we can't.
Yeah.
And then I assume or presume that she is just flying off looking for the others until this moment when she crashes.
Yeah, but as she crashes what looks like a Star Trek shuttlecraft, I think in a current day comic, we would have had a little bit of an aside finding out that somehow Doom had been tracking her, knew all of this, and he set the map and stuff and put things into play. No, not to say we definitely would have, but I could see that sort of a thing happening.
Yeah, that aspect I'm a little more lenient on. I mean, it's a ship. She's having struggles flying it. The fact that several days passed from when she took off in this ship to when she started having trouble flying it, that's the part that's more convenient to me than anything else.
Did a couple of days pass? I'm trying to remember.
Well, she left at the end of that storm. The X-Men have had time to find the heroes, get in the battle with Galactus, find the villagers, get healed.
I mean, to me, that's an afternoon.
Okay, maybe it's an afternoon. The point is, if she was having as much trouble as she indicates in this flying the vehicle, so much so that she crashes, it seems like that would have happened much sooner than that gap of time we didn't see her in.
Agreed. She'd been flying aimlessly and moderately successfully for quite some time.
Yes, and then all of a sudden goes, man, I can't fly this thing. She didn't run out of fuel or nothing, though. She just figured out she didn't know how to fly.
Yeah.
Suddenly.
Yeah. It does feel like we should have seen at least a mention of her last time or something like that, but yeah.
And the lizard. I mean, we pointed out last recording even that we forgot he was in this story and he was not seen after early in the first issue until this moment.
Well, and when we see him here, she'd been flying for an unknown duration in the ship.
Yep.
Gets the map and then flies on her own power for an unknown duration.
Yes.
Now, this begs a couple of questions. How long has she been traveling and stuff? But also, oh yeah, she can fly. Why did she need the ship to begin with?
Well,
I mean, you could argue she didn't know how far she had to go, or maybe she did know how far she had to go, thought she'd get tired, something like that. Okay, fine. But a line of dialogue wouldn't have hurt.
Fair enough.
But I was surprised when she encountered the lizard, but I was even more surprised with who Doom encounters on Galactus's ship.
Claw?
Yeah.
Now, I'm assuming the whole story he tells is all accurate and correct continuity and stuff people at the time may have known.
I believe it is recapping an issue of Dazzler.
Yeah, I would assume so.
But I do not have said issue of Dazzler, so at least I don't think I do. If so, I haven't looked at it in 3 or 4 decades. But the fact that he was basically explaining, Claw was explaining, he got absorbed by Dazzler, who Doom conveniently reminds us can absorb, you know, sound and transform it into light, and that he then got essentially blasted into Galactus. Explains how Claw, sort of explains how Claw is on the ship. It doesn't explain how Claw's blaster thing, which was not absorbed by Dazzler, is there. Not that it matters.
Except in the artwork, it kind of looks like, well, yeah, the blaster thing isn't.
The rest of him is absorbed.
Yeah, and his clothing and suit or whatever all is, yes.
Yeah, but this is one, it's like, you know, as if we didn't have enough villains going around anyways, Claw's another decent powered one. To bring him out of nowhere was kind of surprising.
Well, and I think it's a fun one.
Oh, yeah, I think it's cool.
And then you get that next sequence where Doom sends him basically back to the base to tell everyone, hey, I'm Doom, and here's what he wants you guys to do. And, you know, he's got the magic password to unlock Ultron that makes Ultron, oh, yeah, he's telling the truth.
Yeah, he sends Claw to the villains with a plan. Now, conveniently doesn't tell us what the plan is, which is a smart writing move.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's just storytelling.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But it begs the question then of what is the game plan and such, and how much of it gets put into play in fairly short order, actually, because when we get some of the stuff that plays out slowly, and this is also one where we get a ton of footnotes, hey, this happened in issue 1, last issue 4, issue 2, whatever, and they keep cutting back and forth to Wasp and Lizard.
Well, and at that point, you also get the cutbacks to the X-Men kind of going back to their crashed ship/base.
Yeah, actually, one thing that I'm curious about is when Professor X is kind of spying on everybody and Enchantress, you know, realizes that and then kind of blocks him mystically from the villains' minds. Did that ever come up later?
Not to where I've read in this or to what I remember in the future.
Yeah, I think it would have been very interesting, and I would not have put it past Marvel to, you know, a few years later in the regular comics, have the X-Men come across the Wrecking Crew and Professor X says, well, I'll just get in their mind and do thus and so, and realize he can't because this is still in play.
Yeah.
That would have been hilarious. I think that would have been great. And that's the kind of thing at that era of Marvel they would do.
Absolutely. And then you kind of get the confrontation between Charles and Storm.
Mm-hmm.
And more of Colossus.
Well, and he's starting to fall for the healer.
Well, yes, but that's not surprising. More other than the fact that somehow Johnny just disappeared and forgot about her, and that's the only part that's semi-surprising. There's the semi-affection between the two. It's weird. It's bad soap opera stuff.
It's definitely soap opera stuff. I'd take it as Johnny was just off doing stuff, probably helping Reed with something or whatnot.
Yes, but you know, a page later he's back, and
yeah,
it's weird, and I don't remember who it was, and I apologize for that. I know somewhere when we mentioned we were doing this on the Slack channel, one of our bigger X-Men fans mentioned something about, oh, it's a pretty good story, except I really could have done without that weird Colossus romance angle.
Yeah, I think some of that was Shooter's attempt just to put some soap opera type stuff in there, essentially.
Yep.
Make it feel like there was some characterization, do a basic love triangle, even though it seemed to kind of come out of nowhere.
Yes.
But with Johnny, it makes sense, because that's just how Johnny is. He'll fall for anybody on any planet, it seems like. But it did seem a little weird with Colossus, to the point of I was wondering if the healing that she does
has some power.
Had some kind of impact on that, yeah.
Yeah, which is perfectly reasonable and not explicitly denied, so it makes sense.
Yeah. Well, and at this point, some of the heroes are getting a little antsy of the Wasp is still out there, we've got to go do something.
Yeah.
The other, I don't say love triangle, but soap opera thing that we get is between Iron Man and Captain Marvel.
Yes. Yep. And we get our one shot of Spider-Man checking in on Hawkeye just to remind us Hawkeye's still there.
Yeah, still there, and both of them are having tech issues. Hawkeye's running out of trick arrows because some of them got scavenged and stuff by Reed, and that Spidey's web shooters have been cannibalized.
Yes.
Again, going back to the mountain scene in the previous issue, issue number 4. So I like how some of that plays in, and that sets up one or two things later that we'll get to.
Yes.
And then Doom had sent a couple of the villains to the volcanic part of the planet to do stuff. Not quite sure what.
That was in Claw's plan, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, no doubt, no doubt. But then the X-Men, in the form of only Wolverine, Cyclops, and Rogue, are out there to stop them. For some reason, when I was first reading it, I had thought more of the X-Men had gone.
Well, no, because you see them, when Storm goes to talk to Charles, you see the three of them take off.
Well, and Professor X clearly says Cyclops will lead Rogue and Wolverine to go observe them.
Yeah, exactly.
So we know Storm's not going, Colossus isn't with them, and that just leaves Nightcrawler kind of unaccounted for. It's just when I got to the point where I found those guys encountering Molecule Man, Doc Ock, Titania, and Absorbing Man, it just seemed like a small group.
It's also interesting. This entire series to this point, the X-Men have been
soundly defeated by solo heroes?
Yes. Yet, while they're defeated here, they hold their own against what would appear to be a fairly significant contingent of the villain, again, mainly defeating the Molecule Man.
Yeah, they did seem to have a much better showing for themselves here against some pretty hefty villains. You know, even if you, at this point in time, want to discount Doc Ock, which if you want to, fine. Again, Absorbing Man alone would have been a serious threat. Molecule Man alone would have been a serious threat. Even though she's new, Titania is, you know, something to consider too. Now we've got Cyclops, Wolverine, and Rogue. None of them are slouches or anything. They're kind of heavy hitters for the X-Men. But it does seem like the X-Men fared better in this battle than they have in many past issues. But they were due for that, I think. Now, I was a little unclear if Cyclops' plan of blasting the volcano was a good idea or a bad idea.
Well, it was an idea.
Well, it was an idea, and Cyclops is like, you know, Doom could have sent them here to open up the volcanoes, so I'll do it. It's like you'd just been there to stop them, and now you're doing it? What's up with that? I didn't understand Cyclops' thinking. And there was no, did I do the right thing or not? Well, there was a line of, I hope I did the right thing, but not the angst-ridden, you know, hemming and hawing that I felt we would have gotten for a few pages around this era of comics.
Yeah, I just, the way you put it, it seems like a much worse idea than it did to me. To me, it seemed like whether or not blasting a volcano is a good idea. Set that aside.
Yeah, just on general principles, it seems like a bad idea. But let's ignore that, because I agree, that wasn't my issue.
But the idea was, the assumption is Doom sent them there to do something useful for their side. And they chased them off, and Scott's like, well, okay, why don't we do whatever could be useful to our side?
And it just happens to be the same thing?
Well, almost like you're fighting over a resource.
Yeah, I get it. If Cyclops had said, you know what, I don't know what they were doing here, but I think we should do this because...
Yeah.
Okay. You know, if it's like, you know, we got this whole Galactus thing, maybe if we set this off, it'll slow him down.
Yeah.
I'd have been fine with that.
Yes, but if the plan was to slow down Galactus, if you thought the villain's plan was to slow down Galactus, you think you would have let them.
Yeah. That's the confusing part.
Fair enough.
There are a couple of times I couldn't tell what various people's motives were.
Yeah.
I did find it interesting when we get back to Wasp and Lizard that some of the Wrecking Crew comes by and she gets blasted. It looked pretty seriously. Like, how is she not dead?
You mean the giant red beam directly through her sternum and then the tree behind her?
Yeah.
That she just kind of shakes off?
And she's down. And I'm almost wondering if when they used the stasis ray to get a Lizard and just happened to get Wasp in there, if the villains inadvertently saved her.
Maybe.
Because it clearly kind of freezes some time stuff there, it looks like. Because the water's solid enough it maybe to pull up. It was weird. And that huge vehicle they're in.
Yes.
Kind of crazy looking, kind of cool, but definitely a little over the top.
Well, yes, but isn't that what you expect? I'm trying to think, which artist is this? This is back to Mike Zeck. With all the orbs and straight lines and windows, you could argue that's trying to do Kirby.
I was almost thinking Transformers, but yeah.
Yeah, but the giant crazy machine and the arms and the wheels with spikes on them. And...
No, I definitely see the Kirby influence.
Yeah, so what else would you expect in a Marvel event?
And there's an aspect of they could make a toy out of this.
Also true.
What I couldn't figure out is I believe they said that Doom wanted Lizard.
Yes.
Why?
I don't know yet, but I'm not finished with the series yet either, so.
That's where I'm at. Again, I'd read it back in the day, but it's been, you know, 30 some odd years, probably more. So I hope there's some payoff on that's all I'm saying.
And to be fair, they don't either.
Yeah.
You know, the Wrecking Crew specifically said, go get Lizard. Yeah, I don't get why. Because Doom told us to, is the answer.
Well, and they're just high-rate thugs at that point.
Exactly.
So, again, I hope there's some payoff for that. What I found interesting is on that last panel of this issue, we've got a shadowy figure, which is actually technically the first appearance of that figure, that character.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
We get her, I believe, in the first page or two of the next issue.
Oh, no, she's in the giant splash page that is the first page.
Yeah, and she's even on the cover of it. It's the Julia Carpenter Spider-Woman.
Yes.
And this is where we get confirmation that a suburb of Denver was brought to Battleworld. Presumably, that's where Volcana and Titania came from, because they grew up in Colorado, so I guess. But in this issue, you know, we get the new Spider-Woman for 3 pages, and then when Wasp gets dumped off by the Wrecking Crew, I don't think we see her again this issue.
No, she's talking to Cap. The villains show up and throw Wasp out. You're right. At that point, she kind of disappears.
So literally, she's there for a few pages to introduce herself, show that she's strong, and that's about it.
Well, show off a version of a new spider suit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, had to have that so we could get to some payoff next issue, maybe. And I like this character. She's fun. I've liked her in other stuff. But depending how you look at it, some people would chase issue, I guess, 6, where technically she's first appearing, even though you only see the shadow. Others would say 7 is kind of the first real appearance and go for that, you know. So there's some value speculation type stuff that I always find kind of hilarious with comics. Because again, technically the previous issue was her first appearance, even though she doesn't totally appear in it.
Yeah.
And then I had forgotten that at this point, Wasp had died.
Apparently that is the case, and yeah. And apparently this magical healer is not this good.
Well, there's almost dead and there's dead.
There is, and I agree with all of that. It's just, it's implied that she's not brought in dead, but she is brought in injured beyond this healer's ability, which seemed vast and amazing to this point.
She-Hulk mentions she's not breathing and there's no pulse.
She does.
So I wasn't sure if Wasp was already dead when she got, you know, tossed out by the Wrecking Crew.
That is true.
But everybody seemed quite confident she was dead.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And reasonably upset, which is understandable. But they've got to, you know, be ready to act if Galactus decides to start chowing down on the planet. So I thought that was interesting and made sense.
Yeah, it seems like a reasonable threat.
Not to be callous, but there is an aspect of Wasp is already dead. She's not going to get deader. Whereas if Galactus gets hungry, you all could get deader.
Yes.
So we get a little bit of the X-Men trying to pin in Molecule Man, Titanium Absorbing Man, and Doc Ock by, you know, converging from different directions, which I thought was an interesting plan, but there's an aspect of they could just fly away. They're in a shuttlecraft kind of a thing. But we got some interesting character moments on a few of those, and particularly when Volcana goes to Enchantress because she sees that Molecule Man is in bad shape.
Yes, exactly.
So I liked that. I'll be honest, I'm not totally up on Enchantress enough to know all of her powers. It seems to be she's magical and can pretty much do whatever's needed for the story.
Yeah, well, and you kind of get the, I don't know, not only do you get the moment with Enchantress, you get the moment with Titania as well, and kind of that relationship. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely plays up. These two know each other, and, you know, there's backstory to be had there. So I like how, with a couple of lines of dialogue, they kind of flesh these characters out a little bit more and more every time we see them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And can do some of it without a big info dump. But then when the X-Men kind of converge on them, unsurprisingly, another fight breaks out. And this is another one where I think the X-Men do pretty good, but Titania, she's like deflecting Cyclops' blasts and stuff like that. So she's being shown to be fairly powerful.
Well, yeah. I mean, since they were created, introduced, whatever, in this series, they both seem to be pretty powerful.
Yeah, I think they're both pretty powerful, but she, to the point of, again, Cyclops' blast just bouncing off her, surprised me. To me, that puts her in the upper echelon of power levels for the villains and stuff, along, you know, an Absorbing Man and those type, well above, say, a Wrecking Crew type.
Well, yes, for Wrecking Crew.
Yeah, well, I did think the fight between Wolverine and Absorbing Man was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Wolverine's got claws, so they're going to come out and, you know, if you're absorbing the powers of something and you're going to go fight somebody, stone good, not great.
Yes, but the scene of him carrying his ball and chain in one hand that is severed being carried by the other hand is just...
Yes, it is kind of hilarious. And him basically, it's like, you know what? I'm going to take my toys and go home. He was very much trying to get out of there.
Oh, yes.
Don't blame him at all. And at this point, with Volcana kind of blasting at the X-Men and such, it does make me wonder, you know, how is her power ranking versus, you know, Human Torch and a few others? Because I don't know that they... I mean, she's powerful and enough to keep the X-Men at bay for long enough for those villains to get away.
See, it's weird. Of all of them, and again, just odd things, not that any of this is important to the story. To me, the odd power thing is when they go, hey, we need to construct a massive rock wall to protect Magneto and Rogue. I would not have thought of Rogue as the person that.
Yeah, she's more holding it up than anything.
Yeah, and then Charles goes, you know, she can't hold it for... I'm like, I didn't think Rogue could have held it at all.
Why not? I mean, she's got super strength.
Sword, yeah.
She's got all that from Ms. Marvel.
Okay. See, I always think of her powers as more... The whole touch and absorbing.
It is, but because she had absorbed Ms. Marvel's powers for so long at one point, they kind of became imprinted on her and stuck. That's how come she can fly, has super strength, durability and stuff, in addition to her regular mutant powers.
Fair enough.
And this would have been not long after all of that had happened.
Well, yeah, because... Yeah, she's new to the good side at this point.
But it's interesting because she's using those powers versus, you know, laying hands on Absorbing Man to duplicate his for a bit, or Volcana, although I could see why she wouldn't want to do that. But certainly she could have, you know, laid hands on Titania and absorbed her powers and duped it out.
Or just Magneto and just built twice as big a wall.
Wouldn't have done it with Magneto because it takes that other person out of action.
Oh, that is true.
But I don't know that we've seen Rogue use her mutant abilities in this story.
I don't think we have.
And until we talked about it, I hadn't even really thought about that. Now, at this point, we do a little bit more with Doom in Galactus's ship, and Galactus basically realizing he's got an intruder and then just kind of, you know, zapping Doom and expelling him down to the planet and such.
Yeah, that is the moment where he finally like zooms in. Oh yeah, okay, get out of here. And just, you know, flicks him and throws him out the window like you do with a fly or something.
It surprised me because all of this talk of we are but, you know, insects to him and such. Okay, you're about to devour a planet. You've got a fly buzzing around your house. Are you really that worried about it?
Yes. And again, this is going to be a bad choice of word, but that's human nature.
Galactus, not human.
Exactly. That's why I said from the start.
Fair enough. You did.
But it's a universal.
He shouldn't be there, so get him off. Yeah.
Plus, bugs are annoying. You know, you spend hours outside, like, grilling up, you know, a whole side of beef. If there's one fly buzzing around someplace, it's the only thing you think about instead of the side of beef you're cooking.
Yeah. Now, what I hadn't fully appreciated till just now is when we've got this shot of Galactus's ship, both at the beginning and, more importantly, at the end of the scene, we see a decent chunk of this planet seemingly exploding from the volcanic eruptions.
Yes. On it says, what do you say, there's two of them 15,000 miles apart, and which once again goes to the size of this planet. That's huge.
Yeah, there are aspects of that that are perplexing.
Well, the Earth's got a circumference of about 25,000 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So 15 is a solid like 40%.
Yeah.
Yet in this, it looks like about... They're about a quarter of the way around this planet apart, maybe less, maybe a little more.
It does seem like with that kind of thing that the X-Men should have been dealing with the repercussions of Cyclops of having blasted the volcano in their fight.
Yes.
When the villains get back to the base with Molecule Man and stuff, they try to get help for him. This is where I thought it was kind of interesting with Absorbing Man. He's like, yeah, what the hell do I do with my arm? And he's like, you know, I can't stay stone. He's got to eat. Okay. Point. Got that. If he changes back without doing something, he could bleed to death. That's not good.
Yeah, but the solution is so simple and elegant.
Oh, yeah. It's like, hey, my powers are magic. I'll just hold it there and turn back and see what happens. Okay. I'll buy that. It makes sense. He's hurt. He's sore, but not bleeding to death. That's good. And then we get the Wrecking Crew tossing the lizard in a cage.
Well, okay, but You get the beginning of that is the lizard attacking them for killing Wasp.
Yes, that's true.
Which is an important piece.
They had built up a rapport in the previous stuff because she was tending to him out in the swamp or whatever. And then as they're heading back to their various quarters and stuff, we find out where She-Hulk had gone earlier when she had essentially snuck off. She's upset about the Wasp and starts laying into, I think initially, what is it, Bulldozer, and then in short order, the rest of the Wrecking Crew, with Titania coming along shortly thereafter, too.
My favorite part of this whole sequence is the series of holes in the various... Yeah, Jen doesn't use doors. She just kind of... She Kool-Aid mans her way through the whole place.
Exactly. Exactly. It's pretty easy to tell where she's been.
Exactly.
You know, what got me was by the time Titania gets there, She-Hulk is just mopping the floor with the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah.
And we get a pretty good fight scene between her and Titania, and they tended to be adversaries for a number of years after that.
Yep.
And then we get Doom getting back into the base, first time he's seen after having been ejected from Galactus's ship, and he is not in good shape. But then, yeah, the villains are just wailing on She-Hulk.
Well, what is amazing is how quickly the Wrecking Crew is back in this.
Yeah, well, there was a few minutes of her of She-Hulk fighting Titania.
And to be fair, Bulldozers, maybe he's the one that really takes the brunt of that. But they're all kind of showed laid out.
They're all down, but one of them was starting to get up when Doc Ock and Absorbing Man come in. We spend a minute or two over with Doom, and then by the time we're back, the Wrecking Crew is up and literally in full swing. So they do make a pretty quick recovery.
Yeah, and this is the most dejected I think I can ever remember seeing Doom.
Yeah, we don't see him in this kind of state often, if ever.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he is physically wiped out and I think emotionally wiped out.
Yeah. Yeah, you just kind of do whatever you want. I give up. China.
Yeah. And then we cut back to the heroes over at the village. And, you know, they're trying to figure out what to do. They've realized She-Hulk is missing. And that while Cap wants to go after her, like, they got to stay there and fight the good fight. This is where then Colossus finds the healer basically collapsing. And we get to why, I think, in the next issue. But then Professor X contacts Cap saying, hey, we'll keep an eye on Galactus. You go do what you got to do. And Cap's like, okay, situations change. Let's go get those butchers.
Yep.
And I'm like, well, wow, that was pretty militant or whatever. I mean, makes sense. They're upset. I get it. One of the things, though, that got me with this issue, and it was back when we had a lot of stuff with Volcana and stuff trying to get help for...
Oh, and Absorbing Man.
Yeah.
Or Molecule Man.
Molecule Man. There's a fair amount, and it was happening in earlier issues, too, of fat shaming and such.
Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. It's weird because even at this point in time, she doesn't seem fat by any stretch.
No, not at all. No more so than anyone else there. I mean...
Not at all. Is what I think you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. She's in a swimsuit and stuff.
And she looks like everyone else.
Yeah.
And when I say everyone else, I mean all the other heroes, not...
Well, like Enchantress, Titania, and so forth. There's nothing that makes me think, wow, that one's put on a few pounds or something like that. But
exactly.
Plump, pretty, a body as bloated as yours, comments like that.
Well, and that goes back even a few issues. When she got in the first fight with the Wrecking Crew, it's because I think Bulldozer was mooing at her or something.
Uh-huh. That was what I was talking about in the other one that we'd come back to and stuff.
Yeah.
There were just a couple of points where it's like, damn, where did this come from and why? So I don't know. I mean, at this point in Marvel, I thought, and maybe this didn't go that way, but I thought they would put together a plot, the artist would draw the thing, and then the writer would come back and put in the dialogue. And that doesn't, some of this dialogue doesn't fit the visuals. So again, couldn't tell what was going on with that or why.
Well, you needed a reason for the Wrecking Crew and Molecule Man and Volcano to kind of be at opposite sides and be squabbling.
Yeah.
That's a pretty thin reason, but it is.
I guess it's the thinness of the reason that got me.
Fair enough.
We start the next issue with the heroes basically going off to invade Doom Base.
Hang on. How can we move on to the next issue without mentioning this classic cover? Well, it is arguably the first appearance, right? In the famous Amid the Chaos, There Comes a Cost.
Ah, yes. Yeah, it's interesting because with the costume, there was at one point rumor that it was supposed to be black and red or whatever. I was actually just reading this on the web the other day, and they'd actually shown it that way, I think, in Marvel Age or one or two other things. But yeah, this is, again, we've had 7-8 months at this point of Spider-Man in this costume in his own books. So to be getting it now, finally, you know, 8 issues in on the cover of this... And it's a ways into the issue, I think it's near the end, actually, where he gets it.
It's near the end, yeah.
But this was one of the big mysteries of how did it get this way.
Yep.
So definitely doing it on the cover made sense. But it's also weird because at this point, if you go back to, you know, Spider-Woman being on the cover and stuff like that, they were not holding stuff back for the interior reveal.
No.
Because they were using it to sell the books.
Well, and the covers were related to the interior.
Yes. Yes. Well, as you can tell here, with everybody fighting in the background.
Yes.
Jokingly could refer to any issue, but yes. This was something where the covers were specific to the issue, not just, hey, let's do some pinup shots.
Yep. Yeah. And interestingly enough, yes, this is the start of the costume. And interestingly, we see the end of the costume not that much longer after this.
Was it?
Yeah. I was listening to an interview with DeFalco.
Okay.
About that not that long ago. And they're like, he's in the blood. Yeah, it's boring. We didn't. Shooter was like, I had to do it for the toys. Get rid of it. And there's that scene of him taking it off and throwing it down the hill. And I'm trying to remember. I want to say Ron Frenz drew it. I could be wrong. And what ends up becoming Venom was not an idea. Was nothing. It was literally Tom was told by Jim, the costume's got to go back to the old one.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Some of the stuff changes based on who thought something was a good idea and who gets tired of it when.
Exactly.
Or when somebody else gets in power and can change it.
Yeah.
But yeah, this issue starts with a full-on fight between the heroes and the villains and stuff, which is a lot of fun. A little surprised how drunk Enchantress was, but okay.
But it had been kind of, sort of set up the issue before.
Kind of, sort of. Was she already starting to drink there?
You can't tell, but she was clearly in a state of mind that she certainly doesn't, again, you can question if it's good art or bad, but that page where she's staring into the water thinking of Thor,
mm-hmm.
where Doom comes stumbling in, the middle panel, she looks back, it is either just not Mike Zeck's best pencil work, or he was implying she was already potentially not 100% there.
She's certainly not in a good frame of mind or whatever. But in that panel above it, we don't see any wine or anything she's drinking.
Look at the eyebrows and the way she's holding her eyes. Again, it's either really good art or a lucky accident with some questionable art.
Yeah. I was just surprised in the next issue when she was clearly a bit inebriated, enough so that she can barely stand. The fact that Claw broke Lizard out, not too surprising because we'd had that kind of foreshadowed when Lizard was put into the cell.
Well, and Claw was the guy who showed up originally and said, the whole plan is we got to go get the Lizard.
Yeah, but now he's saying, I can't see somebody trapped, so it seems like he's going against the plan.
That may be true as well.
Not knowing what the plan is, I can't tell.
Fair enough.
And the rationale of, I love the way you talk, being enough? Okay, a little thin, but sure. And at this point, you've got to assume a little bit of time has elapsed, because the heroes have gone from the village over to Doom Base. The villains are still wailing on She-Hulk.
Yeah, there's a bit of, kicking a horse when it's down here.
Yeah, it was surprising.
And then the other question is, while all this is going on, Ultron's just been standing there like a statue, guarding Doom, but he wasn't there when Doom got there. What was he doing before that? I don't
know. Last we'd seen him is when Molecule Man came in, and he was basically telling Volcana he can't help because he doesn't have orders.
Exactly. But we saw Doom come in, and the only person outside his chamber kind of was Enchantress. And now we come back, and it's like he's been standing guard the whole time.
Yeah, I wonder, presumably Doom had called him at some point, but how and why? Doom didn't seem to be too proactive at that point.
No.
Again, we get a lot of fight scenes stuff here, some interesting stuff, water getting ripped out from a really huge reservoir inexplicably in the ceiling area of one of the hallways or whatever.
Just to douse Johnny, because it's entertaining.
Yeah, it's fun, but I'm not sure what surprises me more, that it was there or that Doc Ock seemed to know it was there.
The page before that with the Wrecker hitting Iron Man with the crowbar around the corner is one of my favorites, but that's the classic goofy art of comics I tend to love.
Yeah. Well, I love the thought balloon that Iron Man has the next panel. Good thing it was me. If it was anyone else, it'd have cut him in half.
Exactly.
And this time, Absorbing Man gets a little smarter. He's using alien steel before tackling Spider-Man and such.
Yep.
And this is another one where the Thing starts fighting Absorbing Man, only to have himself revert to Ben Grimm kind of inexplicably. Just in time, though, for Spider-Woman to come in and save him. And it's funny, because you would think that would make Ben fairly appreciative of her. I don't recall, and maybe they did it, but I don't recall seeing any kind of payoff on that later on, either in this series or just in general.
Yeah, I don't remember.
You'd think Ben would have a soft spot for her just for helping him out at a time when he needed it.
Yep, that arguably is true, too.
And then this is where we get kind of, I want to say, the showdown between Pile Driver and Hawkeye.
Yep.
And Pile Driver is, hey, I'm bullets bounce off me. And Hawkeye shoots him and wounds him. And I'm trying to remember if this is the one where there's at some point, basically pointing out just how strong Hawkeye needs to be to pull back the bow of the caliber he's got and such. Or if that was somewhere else, I'd read that. But the point being, his arrows hit a lot harder than any bullets. And there's a certain aspect of you've got to justify the archer with the Avengers.
Yes.
And we've got Enchantress seducing the Hulk, trying to seduce Cap, that not working. And then, again, this fight just keeps going, and it's fun.
It is.
It's a little crazy when Titania is moving this huge I-beam or whatever from up in the ceilings. There's parts of me that really would love to have seen more of the architecture of this base for them to have kind of set up that these things could happen, you know, at this point, and how the villains kind of knew. Because she seems to be pretty high up in some large cavernous room, shoving this thing. How she got up there, I'm a little unclear of. But it's fun and it works, so I don't really care. And there's an aspect of this where it's a roller coaster ride and you just go with it and it's fun. Like when we get Hawkeye and Ben Grimm encountering Claw and the Lizard and how they kind of decide to outwit them.
Yeah, I also love that the depowered human version of Ben Grimm apparently does a ton of bench press, but never works on his legs. Giant barrel chest, but the scrawniest legs you'll ever see.
Yeah. Yeah, the physique's kind of funny. And he's standing with legs so wide, it's like...
Yeah. Yes.
That just seems weird. A little surprised Hawkeye recognized him. I guess it had happened earlier, so he'd seen him.
I think Hawkeye saw it when it happened.
Yeah.
Plus, he was there when it happened the previous time.
Well, he wasn't there this time because he was commenting that it was Ben without the rocks.
Oh, yeah.
But I think he was there when it happened the first time. Hard to tell because so much has happened since then. And then when they finally find the heroes find Molecule Man and Volcana, she's keeping them out of the room pretty effectively until Iron Man charges in there. Not exactly, you know, recommended. But then we've got the...
Well, you've got Marvel getting to Molecule. That's really what kind of stops all this.
Yeah, because she goes through the transparent, not invisible, dome he had set up. And this is one of the few times we really see her powers kind of getting used other than for just flight.
Yeah.
And it's funny because when Volcano surrenders because Molecule Man's injured and Captain Marvel's making it worse, Captain Marvel's like, ooh, sorry. You know, I thought that was, you know, showed the humanity of the heroes. I was a little surprised Spider-Man was pretty much able to defeat Titania. Again, he seems to be punching a little outside of his weight class. Dodging, sure, no problem. But then essentially throwing her out of Doom Base, which is suddenly, you know, it seems like on the edge of a cliff or something, or maybe it's just that tall.
I just love the scene where he grabs her by the ankle, only because knees bend, shins don't. That's like a perfect arc.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some of the art is goofy. It's not bad. It is goofy and fun.
Well, and again, it's a different style and expectation of the art from modern day.
Yo, absolutely.
I think if you were to do this in modern day, people would relegate this of, oh, it must be a kid's comic or something. Now, in fairness, comics were for kids back then.
Yes.
But there's an aspect where this is a little, I don't want to say more over the top or whatever, but again, it lacks the subtlety, the nuance, the linger on the moment aspect that we have in modern comics. We've then got Cap and Human Torch going up against Ultron. And man, it really feels like we should have had a comment around Cap having worked with the other Human Torch or something from the Invaders. That would have been a nice moment. But when Cap's telling Torch to use his Nova Flame and such, that was kind of cool.
Yep. Again, another great ankle grab shot where Ultron just... And again, the ridiculously wide-legged stance. Feet outside the shoulders, more stable. Full-on splits, less stable.
Yeah. Yeah, that just seems crazy. I found it interesting when Cap got to Doom and he's like, well, Doom's already defeated. We don't need to worry about him.
Yep.
Not something that would happen today.
No.
But at this point, Doom wasn't... I don't say he wasn't as much of a Captain America villain at the point, but I think those two have a bit more of a hero-enemy relationship now than they did back then.
Well, I mean, at this point, Doom was still pretty just focused on Reed, right?
Yeah, I think so. Again, it was just such an earlier point in the Marvel history.
Yeah.
We then find out again how Ben and Hawkeye, you know, outwitted Claw and Lizard. That was goofy, but it worked. And then finally, Captain Marvel comes across She-Hulk. And then down in the infirmary, Reed and Cap are seeing to, I guess, the Wrecking Crew and She-Hulk.
Yep.
Because at this point, they've basically taken over the base. Because their base had long since been destroyed, and they start putting all the villains in various cells and such.
Yeah, including the Lizard and Kang, which seems interesting. It's almost like they'd worked out a truce and they were all getting along and, I don't know, we got to lock them up.
Yeah, and they seem to regret it a little bit for Claw and Lizard, but... And then we get...
The oddest sequence yet.
Yeah, the Breathe the Vapors again, another recap, and this time we learn a little of how the healer was able to save Wasp.
Yep. Well, it's where we first learned Wasp is alive.
What's weird is just a second ago, we had seen Hawkeye and Captain Marvel in the base, and now they're, I guess, back at the village?
Yeah, I mean... Yes, we see them. Hawkeye says, hey, Captain Marvel and I are going to bring the Wasp body here.
Okay, you're right.
And then they're there.
Well, because at that moment, Colossus is in the alien village, has the dream quest or whatever, and then meanwhile.
Yeah, exactly.
So apparently it just wasn't that far to the Doom base. But yeah, Wasp is alive and well, and then we still got the X-Men keeping an eye on Galactus. We get the look there. Comment, and of course we cut away, because why tell us what we're seeing now? And then we got the scene I had mentioned, I think last episode, about how Reed is helping fix up Iron Man's armor, and Rhodey, not that he's identified as such, is asking, were you surprised there was a black man under here? Reed's like, no, never really gave it any thought, just knew there was a guy under there.
Yeah.
Which again, very Reed sort of comment.
And it's the Marvel Universe. Why would it have to be a human?
Earthbound, I think he would have been surprised if it had been an alien.
Fair enough.
And then we get Thor having gotten a new cape and a new hat. And then Hulk's like, oh yeah, there's a machine in there that goes and does that stuff.
Yes.
Spidey's like, fine, I'll go do that. I guess it's this machine. And then out comes a sphere of black stuff. It gets on him, and boom, he's in the costume.
Yep.
And at this point, Professor X tells the heroes, oh yeah, Galactus is starting to eat the planet.
To be continued.
Yeah. I, with the costume, when the spider sense goes off and he didn't even like immediately back off or something, that was a little weird. And I'm still curious how Hulk and Thor knew which machine to use.
Everyone seems to know how to use all these alien... Again, everyone has no problems with any of these alien machines, except Janet and the shuttle.
Well, and Spider-Man here.
Well, sort of. He wanted his suit fixed. He went to the machine and he created a new suit.
I'm not convinced he went to the right machine.
That's entirely possible.
But Thor does not strike me as the technologically advanced sort of a god.
No.
Hulk, okay, he's got Banner's brains, he's super smart, I'll grant him that. But Peter Parker? Kind of tech savvy. So, whatever. It worked. But yeah, just a page or two there at the end to get that, and it was the cover feature.
Yep. And again, you know, another 30 years of history. It's become such an iconic issue at this point.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. This is a major mile marker in Spider-Man's life, along with, you know, the death of Gwen Stacy. I'm trying to think of other things that would be as momentous. You know, his marriage to Mary Jane, the undoing of the marriage to Mary Jane, you know, things like that.
The undoing of his secret identity.
Yeah. The revealing of it, the unrevealing of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There was a busy couple of years there where we listed off six things and three of them happened in like a 6-month span.
Well, there was a period they were doing like spider event after spider event after spider event. So there are times that they've got more kind of headline level stories for a character. Because in my mind, if you're in, you know, New York or whatever in Spider-Man's world, every so often there's going to be a Daily Bugle headline that's Spider-Man, this, that, and the other. Now, if you take out the getting blamed for something he didn't do or something like that, and go for what's truly newspaper headline worthy milestone in Spider-Man's lives, there are a number of things. Of course, characters been around forever, and some of them clump up more than others.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, we didn't even mention the various Osborn deaths and rebirths. And
or the clone sagas or, yeah.
Yep.
So, for me, all in all, this series is continuing at a good clip. A lot's happening. We got a lot of story progress. We got a lot of action, some character moments. Everybody is pretty much being kept in play for the most part. Some characters a little bit more than others, but it's just a ton is happening in this series.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, this is something where the pace of storytelling back then was just so much faster than it is today. And again, pros and cons, because you never really dwell on something for too long. In a Witness, we get a few pages of Spider-Woman, and then she's just kind of accepted by the heroes. We get a page of the black costume, and then, oh, we got to move on to the next thing.
Well, when Galactus is eating the world, the color of your suit isn't that important.
I completely agree. I definitely think it's a drop everything when somebody says Galactus is devouring the planet you're on. No argument there. But these days, we would have spent a much longer period of time dwelling on a number of these things.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, things that get a couple of panels would get, you know, entire scenes, if not entire issues. And there's a point where spending a little more time in the moment is good. Flesh it out a little better, give it a little more nuance, whatever. But there's other times where if it takes you a 6-issue arc to go, you know, explode the volcanoes and come back, that's a little too long.
Well, and here's the other thing. Many of the great stories that come after stories like this allow you to go back and explore those moments in between. With as there's no moments in between left to explore anymore. You can't go back in 20 years and go, hey, I wonder, you know, something happened in this minute that we didn't, was glossed over, because nothing's glossed over.
Well, it's funny because I don't think that problem is unique to comics.
It's not.
I think it's a matter of modern storytelling, because you're right. There are a lot of times where you could sneak some stories into certain eras of the X-Men or the Avengers or Spider-Man or the Justice League or Batman or whatever. Whereas most stories today being told, either on television or in the comics, it's hard to find the, there was a few days at this point the character could have gone and done something.
Yeah.
Which is ironic given some of these characters are in 15 books or something sometimes, so how do they have time for what they're doing already? But they've, particularly over at Marvel, have had a number of titles where they would kind of do the Untold Tales of Spider-Man or something like that and tell things kind of between classic issues.
Well, and not just those. I mean, legitimately other major stories popped up out of the, again, the simple, hey, we got to get him back in his old suit, take it off and it rolls down the hill.
Mm-hmm.
There's a major character in movies that have come about because of what they were able to do with what happened to that suit after that.
Yeah, because some of it is, okay, we saw this scene and another story picks up, well, here's what happened next that you didn't see back then.
Yeah, exactly. Or, again, the entire Clone Saga kind of is the same thing. It's like, oh yeah, there was that moment and there was the clone and all of a sudden there's a whole new world to explore.
I guess for me, some of that is the camera turned its direction elsewhere and the main character was still doing stuff, but there was this other thing that if you'd paid more attention to, you would have seen.
Yeah.
The Clone Saga, the, you know, whatever sort of a thing.
That is true. Take time. Maybe I'm wrong, and maybe in 30 years there will be those scenes in today's books that they can go back and do the same thing with. I don't know.
If so, I would think a lot of it would have to happen between trade paperback arcs, and you've got fewer inroads than it would feel like you had for classic stories.
Yeah.
Because I think you could tell some stories around this era of the Avengers or the Fantastic Four or whatever, because an issue ended in an arbitrary amount of time, maybe the next day, the next afternoon, maybe a week later, the next issue starts.
Yeah.
Whereas now everything is just so, I don't say interconnected, but I don't know, because there was a period in time, like with Superman, where his story seemed to be, you know, just the everyday in the life of. But you could still squeeze stories in there.
But yeah, I've said for years, other than basically the post-crisis Superman up through about Zero Hour is my favorite, which kind of, you know, is from Man of Steel basically through the end of the Shield era. Is some of my favorite stuff, because those stories really did feel like just the next day in that character's life, or next week, or whatever.
Yeah, there was a sense of we were following the life of this character, not the stories of.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's some great stuff there. So I'm really enjoying Secret Wars here.
Me too.
It's fun stuff. It's a little over the top, in some places a little goofy. And again, it just different storytelling style, again, from what, 30-ish, 35 years ago, whatever. But it's fun, and it is a definite mile marker in the overall Marvel universe to a large extent, just because, again, it was the first time all of these characters were kind of thrown together for a major event.
Yeah, absolutely. This is, I am so glad we've done this. It's been sitting on my shelf, I don't know, 15, 20 years. It's the first time I'm really going through and reading it, so.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to finishing it when we get back together on the next episode for it.
I am as well.
So we've got new previews out for July, or actually it's coming out on June 24th. So I guess we got another few days before it comes out. Deadline for that's going to be July 4th. That is a Saturday. That is the 4th of July, because being July 4th and all. But the deadline is morning of Saturday, July 4th, so well before fireworks start. So please send in some clips. We did not have a huge turnout for the last time, but again, it was kind of a weird previews. It was kind of recapping a lot of stuff that was already announced. Hopefully we'll get some new stuff. I do think they're still slow rolling a few things on the release stuff, but again, hopefully there'll be some new projects to get excited about in the July previews. We also have the recommendation roundtable still going. Send in your picks for older comic books or novels or television shows or movies that people might enjoy and such. A lot of people are still staying home a lot while the pandemic is still playing out in some areas. My area, it's playing out in full swing. We've had record highs for number of new cases this last week and stuff, just head and shoulders above the numbers we've been seeing even the last week or two, which had been some record highs then. So help people find some stuff that they may enjoy spending their time doing. You know, there's plenty of stuff on Netflix or Amazon or just older books people may already have and just need the reminder they should go read. There's no deadlines on the recommendation roundtables. When I get enough clips, I'll put another episode out. I do have enough for a third episode that I'll be releasing soon, but I'd like to have some clips for a fourth before I do that if I can. So we got that. And like I said, July 4th deadline for the preview spotlight. Anything else?
I'm good.
Cool. Join us next time as James and I talk about Love and Capes number 1 through 4, and in 2 weeks when Sam and I come back to finish off Secret Wars covering issues 9 through 12.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.